We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.
Now with the MLB app, you can get baseball your way. Pick your favorite team, your favorite players, and get customized highlights, stories, and breaking news right on your home feed. Follow the action with Game Day, where 3D replays add another dimension. Plus, notifications can keep you connected to every pitch, every hit, every game. The MLB app. Baseball, your way. Download it now for free from the App Store or Google Play. Blackout and other restrictions apply. Major League Baseball trademarks used with permission.
Loud and Local continues on The Rock with Kevin Deers, 99.9 KISW.
It's Loud and Local. I'm doing something called the Stay Home Sessions. Last time you heard, I was talking with Kathy Faulkner, a legend in Seattle rock radio. Right now I'm talking to Dave Larson, who is, you might not know his name, but you probably should, because he's put out some incredible records. He puts out incredible content, both podcasts, YouTube. He's a writer. He's an all-around just an interesting, creative guy. So he's someone that I've looked up to. I started going to hardcore shows in, like, 2002, 2003, and I always knew him from Excursion Records. That was Dave Larson, man. So yeah, dude, Dave Larson, I've wanted to have you on the podcast. I've wanted to have you up on the show. Obviously we can't get into the studios right now. Everything's on lockdown, but, how are you doing, man? How are you holding up? How's quarantine treating you? How are you staying sane?
I'm doing great. You know, quarantine is a pretty terrible thing for everybody, but, I don't want to say I enjoy it, yeah. But it suits me at this point. Like I have so much editing and, like you said, you know, I don't want to say content creation because it sounds so pretentious, but I had this quarantine thing came along right at the time when I just had a ton of stuff that needed my attention.
Yeah.
So for right now, I'm still working on a backlog. I suppose when that runs out here in a week or so, I'll start actually looking around going, oh, no, what now? But I still feel like I haven't come up for air. So being home is kind of what I mostly would have been doing anyway right now.
So when you're not, you know, quarantined, do you have like a day job that you have to go to, or are you pretty much a working from home kind of guy anyways?
Such an interesting question you ask. So, okay, I do podcast engineering for Cadence Leadership.
Yeah, that's a Rams thing. Yeah, I listen to your podcast.
Yeah, Ram Arslanian's company. Mm-hmm. And so that's not full-time yet. Mm-hmm. Hopefully that is something that it's moving towards. But between that and various like production assistant jobs that I'll do in the film industry, and then my own gigs that I have that I've created for myself, which is doing my own podcast. I'm working on this YouTube channel now, and I do a lot of like reselling online. I've always been like an eBay, you know, seller.
Yeah.
And then even before the days of the internet, I was selling stuff through like magazine ads. So it's kind of, I've piled up like a number of different odd jobs type thing. But in terms of like, you know, punching the clock and going in Monday through Friday, no, I haven't had that for a long time.
You mentioning something about film there had me think, like, how could I have not have introduced you as the creator of one of the most iconic Northwest hardcore films, Edge of Quarrel?
No.
Wait, no. I just said one of the most iconic Northwest hardcore films. How are they, are there any other Northwest hardcore films? I don't think so. This is...
Oh, yeah, sure there are.
There are?
I mean...
Moshbot?
Yeah. I mean, yes. Yeah, you asked and answered the question, I think.
So I must get into a couple Edge of Quarrel questions a little bit later, but you are a man of you've kind of cobbled together all kinds of you're selling on the side, you're doing podcast engineering, you're doing some film stuff, but somehow it all squeezes into like making a living, I would hope. And
you could say that. I suppose that, you know, my lady might think it could be definitely better.
Well, okay, so
it's a group effort around here. I throw in as much as I can. Sometimes it's better than others, you know.
So there was a time where I'm not sure how far this project went, but you were trying to get $1 million worth of pennies. Is that correct?
Oh no, that is incorrect. And I hate to. I should yes and you. I'm sorry.
Okay, no, it's okay. No. You can mansplain me.
Yes, and actually, what it was $1 million.
Oh, $1 million. Okay, so
$1 million in pennies is really staggering. A staggering amount of metal. And I have to say, $1 million would have been a real true staggering amount of metal also. I only got up to like 40,000 pennies. And then it became too much to move those things around the house.
And did you just go to the bank and you're like, here you go?
Yeah, in the end. And that thing didn't. Okay, and the truth about the penny project is what I was calling it.
Yeah.
Was I had kind of ground down into a place in my life where I had no like creative output. Things weren't happening with the label. Things mm-hmm. had gotten weird kind of locally, the music scene. And I didn't have an output and I didn't really know how to respond to that.
Mm-hmm.
And so I started the Penny Project as something I could do online and maybe solve some of my financial issues. My idea was it would lead me to something where I could see a different route
yeah.
with what I was doing. And so I wasn't, I mean, the million pennies wasn't going to do it, but it was just going to be a project to move me in a good direction. And that happened much faster. Like that, things outside of the Penny Project overtook my life and I couldn't really keep it up anymore. So rather than just flog a dead horse, I was done with it.
Dude, I'm thinking now, like, if this were to work in the time of, like, you know, doing your YouTube, you could do, like, you know, that Suicidal Tendencies song, Send Me Your Money? You could do, like, you could do, send me your pennies.
Well, so I'm kind of doing the opposite thing, send me your pennies. I'm kind of trying to do the opposite thing with YouTube where I'm like searching coin rolls. One of the things I do is I do coin roll searching, which I didn't know was a thing.
Okay.
And you find kind of like rare error coins and like silver coins that like things that shouldn't have made it into the regular money supply.
Huh.
And you pull those out. So you get them from the bank, you get them at face value, and then sometimes you can find things that are worth more. But I'm going to be giving all that stuff away.
Oh, wow.
To watch the channel.
Okay.
So really it's the other way. Don't send me money. Watch my channel. Maybe I'll send you money.
Ooh, you got to have one of those, like, remember that guy who was like, had a commercials where he was wearing that like dollar bill suit.
no, that guy, well, he was had to find free government grant.
Exactly.
Money.
Exactly. You need one of those suits.
I looked through that book once. Oh, I think that would be too. One, I would be embarrassed. And then other people would be like, yeah, that's too on the nose.
Okay, so we gotta get into this. So you said it's kind of cringy to say content creator, but I'll just say, man, there you know, move over 13-year-old toy unboxers, Dave Larson's the new YouTuber. So I listen to your podcast. I've known you too long, and a lot of Northwest music knowledge in there, and you just go down on these rabbit holes of just like it's like deep dives with people that you've literally known. You say you've known too long, and you know everyone from Ron Gardapi, RIP, to John Pettibone, to Greg Benning from Trial, from people that literally I've never met, I've never even heard of, but you have such a good conversational skill and such a good podcasting, you know, like, I don't know, just a manner about you that it's just an interesting listen. And sometimes episodes go to 2.5 hours, but it's a great listen.
Thank you for saying that.
Yeah, it's a great listen, man, and I would definitely suggest it if you want to know about some get into the weeds of underground Northwest punk and hardcore and emo and just you know, the stuff that didn't necessarily rise up to the like sub pop or quote unquote grunge level. You were in the thick of it as far as like the early 90s hardcore and punk, and I want to get to that, but as far as what made you pivot to, you know, taking things to the YouTube channel? And I actually have not subscribed, so I'm going into this ignorant. What is your focus on YouTube, dude?
So okay, so the channel is called Quarter Bash, like a quarter, you know,
yeah,
that you'd put in a video game, and then bash, like, well, I don't know, it sounds like quarter flash, and I literally, it doesn't mean anything. I was just one morning I just had the epiphany that that was a cool sounding name for a channel where you, a lot of the channel would be looking at coins.
Okay.
So, So it goes to this. I've actually done things on YouTube for a number of years, really sporadically. If people go out there, you can find a video that is a guy eating crazy bread. It's called The Proper Way to Eat Crazy Bread and Sauce.
Okay.
That's me. I'm up there as a person named Doug Lawless, which is like an alter ego thing that I was doing for a while. So that's the kind, I would just make silly stuff like that, like proper way to make top ramen. I just made a bunch of dumb, like fun videos like that. And I'd put up music videos like, you know, a botch video here and there, stuff like that.
Sure.
But lately I'm trying to focus a little bit because, you know, I feel like that would be smart. My dad is a big prospector. Like my whole life he was obsessed with getting out into the world, and he's obsessed with looking for gold mainly.
Oh, wow.
And he's not like a – like he likes to like walk on the ground and like – you know, get in the streams with a gold pan. He's literally like an old school guy. He
wow.
would have been, my dad would have been totally fine 200-300 years ago, just like out in the woods trying to find something, you know?
Yeah.
And I honestly, he doesn't ever find a ton of anything. I've always thought he really loved the process, and that's just kind of his way of enjoying the world.
Yeah.
And he has found a bunch of cool stuff. Like he's got wild stories, but, that's in my blood a little bit. And for me, it always came through in, this is going to sound crazy maybe, but I shouldn't use that word. This is going to sound strange, but I've always felt like that's why I was so attracted to things like record collecting.
Yeah.
Because I'm always looking for the gems out in the wild, you know?
Uh-huh.
And so even back in like the, like, you remember Maximum Rock and Roll?
Of course.
I assume people know Maximum Rock and Roll. They used to have a classified section. So even before the internet, before anyone was using the web, people were buying and selling and trading records in the back of Maximum. So I started doing that when I was still in my teens. And so this channel, I know this is a long way to get around to it. I apologize.
You got
this
me.
This channel is basically all forms of treasure hunting in my life. So whether it's going out and finding rare vinyl or cool collectible things, I like toys and miniatures and nerdy stuff like that. Or I just discovered, you know, that people are doing magnet fishing. Do you know what magnet fishing is?
Not at all.
People get these super powerful magnets, put them on ropes and throw them into lakes and rivers and see what kind of stuff they could pull out.
Wow.
And they're finding like, okay, this is an extreme example, but like, you know, every once in a while you pull like a gun that someone disposed of.
Oh my God.
Or, you know, it just, so, and you know, the way I find out about this stuff is watching all this stuff on YouTube.
Yeah.
And I absolutely love it. So, one of the things that was simple that I realized I could start doing at home was coin roll searching. And that's, you just go get a box of coins from the bank and then you just open them all and search all the coins. And, you know, you get half dollars, you get 50 cent pieces. Every once in a while, there's a silver one from before 1970. And those are worth more money than 50 cents. So you're literally just taking something, you're just making something from nothing, kind of. And it was surprising to me that there were so many people that were into this and thought it was interesting. And the more I got into it, the more I realized I want to do this. I want to be part of this. I'm going to add it to my whole kind of overall treasure hunting thing.
Yeah.
So I decided to make a channel about it.
Is this something that, you know, you want, you have any desire to, like, you know, grow and is there a place for monetization in the world of quarter bashing?
Yes.
Ooh.
There is, but I mean, I'm not really like, I feel like, so I just passed 100 subscribers.
Okay. Yeah.
So, and I started it in February. So it's just like, I'm just getting going. So if you start thinking about, oh, I'm going to make all this money, but no. No, I don't think that's a good way to approach it necessarily. I think I just want to have fun and make cool stuff and see how many people I can get involved. If it grows to the point that it makes money, cool. If it doesn't, as long as I'm having a good time, I got to do something with my time.
Hey, that's how I started in radio, you know, college radio. I was like, you know, I just wanted to do it. I love it. I loved the, and at this point, you know, if radio ended tomorrow, I would still do a podcast. I would just do this. Like, I'm at home recording stuff on my own time because I love the process. And if you just love the process, then that's the most beautiful thing about it is in the end, like, you know, you don't necessarily, it's not about the end. It's, you know, or like the means to the end or whatever, whatever that way of saying it, like, you just love the process. Yeah. You know, I mean, that's the whole thing with tying this back to everything that I know about you is, and through listening to your podcast, and it's not like you probably ever imagined that, you know, Excursion Records would become like Elektra Records or something. Like, it was
I was just going to say, I did a punk rock record label for over 20 years. I had been definitely not that into making money.
Yeah. Let's pivot to that, man. So, okay, well, let me ask you this one, and there's a question that, you know, you may have answered before, but it's something that I like to ask, and even if it's embarrassing, if you can think back to the first time that you actually spent money, your own money, on an album, what was the album that you purchased?
Oh, you know, I ask this of people all the time.
But no one's ever asked you.
And I may have... So for me, it's weird because I break it up in terms of, like, you know, I always think of like punk rock or hardcore, mm-hmm. because that was like the place where like my musical taste kind of became my own and changed. And, you know, so.
But you weren't born cool, Dave.
So the first thing I can remember ever getting that was my own is not a full length album. It is the Queen 7-inch.
Nice.
With the Flash Gordon soundtrack theme song.
Nice.
It's got the Flash theme, and then the other side's got the song that plays during like the football game in that movie.
Uh-huh.
It takes place in the throne room. I think that's the first thing that I got that was mine, that I either spent allowance money, mm-hmm. or I don't know how I got it. Right around that same time, the Grease soundtrack.
Yeah.
Also a big thing. Within a very short period of time, I also had the soundtrack to the Muppet movie, which might sound weird, but I had that and AC/DC Back in Black.
Nice.
So I have always felt like if you take the Grease soundtrack, the Muppet movie soundtrack, and AC/DC and like smash it together and you blend it up, you might get like my perfect pop punk song.
That's a good point. Hey, and they'd probably look like Social Distortion, you know, if they put the Grease thing.
Exactly.
So what, you know, what was kind of your gateway to punk rock, to underground music? I know in your podcast, you've mentioned that you actually ran your own skateboard store.
So, if you tell too many aspects of my story, it begins to sound like someone just making up lies. So I just want to, I understand that, but these things are true.
Okay.
So when I was 16 years old, I opened up a skateboard shop with my friend Randy up in Bellingham, Washington.
Yeah. So I went to college in Bellingham. Can you tell me like exactly what was it, like Fairhaven neighborhood or?
No, it was basically Kitty Quarter from Whatcom Middle School on the corner of DuPont and F Street.
I know exactly what you're talking about. Wow. Okay.
Yeah. It's now a coffee shop called like Letter Street Coffee or something.
Okay.
Like
okay.
And, yeah, it had been a skateboard shop before. So there had been a skateboard shop called Wipeout that we used to go to, and then they closed. And when we got this idea, my friend's father said, "You guys spend so much money on those skateboards, you should open a store."
At 16 years old.
Well, he said that to us as a passing comment at dinner. And we both put our heads together and went, "You think he was serious?" And so we put a proposal together, like a pitch basically to his dad, saying like, "Loan us the money." And
oh my God.
I had like $400 of my own money, so I thought I was rich.
Yeah.
And so like we opened the thing for like $2,500 total, and we like the rent on the building was less than $200 a month.
Oh my God.
So it was, I mean, it was very, it's just pennies compared to today.
Yeah.
So we did this, and yeah, and we were the only ones it wasn't like there was a parent that worked in there and we worked for them. Like, no, they helped us with things that we couldn't do, like co-sign on the lease because we were 16, or or like, you know, my dad helped us build shelving and stuff.
Yeah.
But they, you know, they didn't work. Like, we were the ones that were in the store every day.
That's a dream come true.
It was cool. I have the photos and I have the memories. And so I know that it happened, but when I think of it, it doesn't seem possible.
So when you're running this shop, is it the skateboarding that gets you into punk rock, or is it punk rock that gets you into skateboarding, or do they kind of happen at the same time?
Yeah. We got there by way of another conversation. So I was walking with a friend of mine right at the beginning of high school, like right in between like junior high and high school, walking to a 7-Eleven. He had his boombox, and he said, "You've got to hear this crazy band I just found."
Uh-oh.
A friend made me a recording of this. It was Suicidal Tendencies.
Nice.
It was the first album. And so hearing "I Saw Your Mommy and Your Mommy's Dead" and "I Shot Reagan," all the stuff on that record that is really out there, right?
Yeah,
and all
yeah.
I wanted was a Pepsi. That walk was the first time I heard him say, "All I wanted was a Pepsi."
Uh-huh.
Like, that was a life changer. Like, there was no, like, we walked maybe six blocks to a 7-Eleven and then back to his father's apartment. And then my life had changed. And from that point on, he was my conduit to music. So he immediately went out. He had more contacts than I did for people that could get music. So the next thing he came back with, like a week later, was like a Sex Pistols tape.
That's awesome.
And we were kind of like, why did we not know about this? And then as soon as you do that, as soon as that door is cracked open, you start trying to force it open. It's like, well, are there magazines that talk about this? Are there movies? What is this stuff? Like, you know, Repo Man, what's this movie? Oh, hey, Thrasher Magazine has punk music in it, but look, skateboarding is cool.
Yeah.
Do we get these skateboards? They're very expensive, you know, and then just for whatever reason, that overtook my whole group of friends and we all got into skating. This was like fall and winter of 1985.
Wow. And then
so
you just kind of go down that path and then, I mean, how long until you're seeing like hardcore shows and stuff? Because I remember the like iconic photos of like Inside Out at in a garage in Bellingham. How long of a time period before you discover this new crazy caustic sounds to then going and seeing it live and booking these bands and seeing these bands and playing in these bands?
Okay, so I would say the Inside Out show is April. In fact, the Inside Out show was 30 years ago yesterday when
wow.
we were recording this.
Awesome.
It was April of 1990. So 4 years.
Okay.
So 4 years when you're a teenager. 4 years from 16 to 20. So
oh, that's
those
important.
Years aren't like – they're not like now.
Yeah.
Like it's like your whole life is happening in front of you. You're just becoming an adult, and a monk is a long time.
Yeah.
You know? So – 4 long years of like, you know, in that time we opened and closed the skateboard shop. While we were doing the skateboard shop, my friends and I were all doing different band things too. And then that's how we were discovering, like, you know, meeting Ron and discovering Brotherhood and coming to Seattle and expanding our world that way. And then all of a sudden it's like, well, we should figure out how to do shows. The how did we book the show? That goes back to a band called Filthy McNasty, which was a high school punk rock band.
Great name. Yep.
It was a good name. They were like a skate rock band.
Yeah.
And two of those dudes were straight edge guys or became straight edge guys. That band broke up and those two guys started another band called First Step, which was a straight edge band from Bellingham. And they inherited the PA that Filthy McNasty had bought. Filthy McNasty would play parties and those would be their shows, right? So we'd go to a party and they'd have this PA and they'd drag the stuff out somewhere and everyone would get drunk and there'd be a mosh pit.
Okay. Yeah.
First Step got that PA. And so they made that. I ended up buying that PA eventually so that we could basically just keep it, in the scene and put on shows with it. It wasn't good or anything, but it was something. So that's how, you know, it was a combination of having that equipment and then wanting to make shows happen that weren't like drunk parties, but actually were like hardcore shows. So Bill Baker, who's a close friend of mine from childhood, he ended up being a guy that was really great at contacting people and talking. So he started saying, "Hey, yeah, we could do a show." And Bill's the kind of guy that will say, "Yeah, we can do something," especially back then, and then you had no idea you could do it. You would just figure it out.
Yeah.
So he'd kind of get us into jams, and then we'd get out of them by doing the show.
And this is all, I mean, pre-internet, like just social networking. So when you say book a show, do you mean like actual make a phone call or like snail mail? Like how do you book shows back then?
Well, Bill did it. I'm honestly like he was the point of contact and he was making himself the point of contact, which is good.
Yeah.
So, and I feel like I was talking Bill down there a minute ago. Yeah, he'd get us into jams and that he'd be like, hey, we have a show we have to put on in 2 months.
We can
find
do
a
it.
Place.
Yeah.
And book. Yeah. And so, which was a great jam to get in, you know?
Uh-huh.
So, yeah, Back of Maximum Rock and Roll was a big thing. Contacts, everybody that you knew in a band that would go on tour, they'd have contacts and phone numbers and stuff. And these phone numbers would get passed around. So Bill would start getting phone calls saying, like, you know, Ron Gardapi said you were the guy to talk to about a possible show in Bellingham.
Nice.
Stuff like that. And then, you know, as it went on, you just became part of like the contacts, or it wouldn't matter. Like Ron was a definite contact in Seattle.
Mm-hmm.
And he was doing Overkill Records and doing ads in Maximum mm-hmm. and doing Scene Reports and all that stuff. So he would often say, I can get you 2 shows in the Northwest, or I can get you 3 shows in the Northwest. And then he would like subcontract shows. He'd call Bill and say, make this show happen. I'm going to bring these guys up. We're going to do Bellingham and Vancouver and Seattle.
So it was like a network of people that were like plugged in and like hyper plugged in. That's cool.
Yes. Yes, and it doesn't function without Ron, pretty much.
That's awesome.
You know, we always talk of Ron as being so important to the creation of the Northwest hardcore scene, but that's because he's always right at the center of things back then.
Yeah, and if you're listening to this and you don't know Ron Gardapi, know that he is an awesome guy. He passed away just this past year. He was a singer of Brotherhood. He was in some other killer bands. Let me see here. What other bands did he do? He did
Resolution. Hateful Youth.
There was another band that he sent me.
Die Down?
Yeah, that was the band. That was Die Down. That was a really cool song that he sent me. But Ron,
I played bass in that.
Nice. Well, there you go.
It was all. I mean, that's all Mark from Undertow. Like that was with Mark and Ryan from Undertow. And so, like, I feel like, you know, I'm glad that Ron and I were able to be involved in that. But those two are quite a combination musically.
Listen to the podcasts with Ron Gardapi on the I've Known You Too Long feed. Subscribe to that and definitely listen. And the thing that's interesting is not only do you listen to the Ron Gardapi, but if you do a deep dive in all of the episodes, I think that his name comes up more often than not with mm-hmm. at least conversations with people that are involved in DIY and Seattle hardcore and underground music. You know, you talk to John Pettibone and he'll talk about how, you know, Ron Gardapi is the first person who gave him, you know, these tapes and would bring him to shows at Natasha's and all these things. So it's like, you're totally right, man. He's that common thread and it's not without him, you know, there'd be a lot less hardcore kids in Seattle, at least at that time. And then, you know, I think, R.I.P. Ron, man. Awesome dude.
Yeah. Yeah.
So
he is missed.
Absolutely. So Blaine from The Accused AD, I saw him post on Facebook. He said something about, like, you know, what are some like 4 or 5 people that, you know, that are no longer with us that you would just love to party with or go to a show with? And the first thing was like, man, Ron Gardapi. That was definitely someone I would love to see a metal show with. I remember one time, it was a few years back, but I just had an extra pair of tickets from Metal Shop for Slayer. And it was I hit up Ron, and he's like, are you kidding me? He just happened to be in Seattle. And he sent me a Brotherhood, the Southern Lord reprint. He sent me a Brotherhood test press and a T-shirt.
Oh, that's super nice.
Just because I gave him a pair of Slayer tickets that would probably have gone to waste. Or, I'd give them to another friend or something. But, you know, I wanted to hook up a friend. But he was such a good dude, so...
Absolutely.
So
it had a huge impact.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, we're talking about the early days of booking shows, and talking about that. And what inspired you to do it yourself and start your own label? So Excursion Records. We'll get into some of the albums you put out, but what made you want to start Excursion Records?
So it was a combination of having done the skateboard shop.
Yeah.
And seeing Ron do Overkill Records.
There's Ron again.
Like, yeah, well, yeah, absolutely. And then Brian Bauer, who lived with Ron, was also doing a record label. That was a label called Scorch. And
cool.
They put out a bunch of, they put out the Resolution 10 inch, and they put out a bunch of other great stuff. Galleon's Lap, which was a band with Greg Anderson from Brotherhood and Sun, and just a, he did a bunch of other good stuff. Then he became, he also ran a label in the Northwest called RX Remedy a little bit later.
Okay.
Which did more stuff kind of like in conjunction with Sub Pop. I hope I was saying that right, Brian, if you're listening. But those guys lived together. And so I was seeing like all the activity they were doing with their labels. And I was like, okay, these are guys I can ask, like, what pressing plan are you using? How do you do it?
Mm-hmm.
And both Bill and I were in the process of doing labels. And then mine ended up getting off the ground. And it was weird. I was trying to put together a compilation for my first record, and the only, and it was going to be mostly hardcore stuff, but the only band that was coming through for me was this pop punk band called 1007.
Mm-hmm.
So I ended up doing like a pop punk 7-inch first, and just learning like how you make the orders, how you, you know, how you do all that. And I was, it wasn't that alien, because like I had just got done, like I started the label, the first release came out in 1990, but we had closed the skateboard shop 6 months earlier. So the shop was open for 2 years, and I basically was in that same situation, kind of with the Penny Project. I think themes are going to repeat in my life.
Yeah.
I had to have a project. Like I had to have something mm-hmm. to be doing creatively. So with the shop down, I started doing a zine, and then I'm like, well, I do a zine. I should do a record label to go along with this. And so I just started Excursion Records.
And after all the years of doing the label, and from what I understand, the label is retired at this point?
Yeah, I mean, I don't – the last release was a thing with Greg Bennett called Legant.
Okay.
And then that was – I already wasn't going to be doing any more with it.
Okay.
So that was kind of a fun project with a friend. If next year, like, I just decided I wanted to put out another Excursion record, I would.
Mm-hmm.
But for the – yeah, like – there's nothing happening with Excursion now. In terms of it being a business, it's dead.
So after so that was quite a run, and for a while there you were putting out pretty consistent releases, and you put out some pretty killer hardcore and underground music in the Northwest, and I would encourage anyone to check out like a Discogs page or something. I'm not sure. I can't imagine you would have like a Wikipedia page or anything.
I don't think there's a Wikipedia, but you can find all the releases on Discogs.
I hate to put you on the spot here, but I do have to. I know it's probably like picking your favorite children, but if someone were to want to deep dive into Excursion, what are five like crucial albums you think that could tell the story, or at least ones that you think are like the cream of the crop? Five Excursion releases.
Well, Undertow, Apple Fence.
Yeah.
Like that's the release of the label, I feel like.
Mm-hmm.
Because those guys are just amazing. It was such a good time, and I was so lucky to be there to be able to be involved in that.
Yeah.
I almost feel like I need a list of them to look at. I did get a chance to put out two records that had Bill Baker singing. Bill Baker's name keeps coming up in this too. He's like, you know, another big, huge influence in my life. He was in a band called Jawbreaker.
Oh, really?
Jayhawker. Jayhawker. No, you can see how I made that mistake.
For sure.
Jayhawker, and then he was in another band called Slow Side Down.
Mm-hmm.
And the Jayhawker Scale Model Failure 7-inch that I put out, and the Slow Side Down Impractical Strategies 7-inch that I put out are, I just absolutely adore them. Let me see. What else have I got? I really feel like there's a lot here to go through, and I'm going to miss some. Left With Nothing, were a big deal for me. The Good Things Come to Those Who Wait CD. It's cheating because it includes the Wishing in Reverse 7-inch, but that's quite a release. I was very happy with that. I wish more had happened with that.
Incredible live band.
What is that?
Incredible live band.
Oh, yes, absolutely. I was really excited to work with To See You Broken.
Oh, yeah.
That was something, that was a band that was, you know, it was a revelation for the idea that there was a, an all-female hardcore straight edge band, you know, like, what? This is something I've been like kind of hoping for. There wasn't a lot of that at the time, and I really loved everything that they did, and I was able to put out a 4-song 7-inch and 8-song CD for them. That was, I really enjoy that. But that, so what is that? It's 5, right?
Yep, that's 5.
Okay, there's other stuff. I didn't even touch on Botch, you know?
Oh, yeah.
Botch was in there, too, so.
Are you surprised at the amount of admiration that Botch has received, you know, posthumous?
No. Like, so let's just be clear. I don't believe that enough admiration could be given to Botch.
Oh, okay.
Like, you can't, like, whatever level they rose to, they were better than that.
Nice.
And that's just, you could see it when they were, just coming out of that phase where they were just done a couple of demos and they were getting ready to release that first 7-inch, you know, even before they became the monstrosity, the amazing thing that they were, you could see it happening. And I've rarely seen a band like that just fire happening. Like I'd go see them, like see like the Velvet Elvis, I'd go see an early Boss show and just know that I was witnessing the rise of something like incredible. And I was telling them this at the time, like I just really, really loved Botch. So seeing what, being able to watch that band become what it did and end the way that it did, and then watch everyone's estimation of them just keep rising after they were gone. It felt like a, I don't know. It was one of those great things. It felt, it must be like what my dad feels like when he says there's gold there. And then there is,
hey, that's a good, you know, kind of comparison. And the thing about Botch is it seems like they're never going to reunite, and that's almost like a magic, a magic about it. But like a part of you wants to see it again, but then a part is like it's, you kind of appreciate that they're like, no, we're just going to let it rest.
Yeah, you can't. I mean, they can't tarnish their reputation if they don't get together and tarnish it, right?
Yeah, exactly.
That being said, I want to see a Botch.
Right.
Yeah.
And if you want to see some killer Botch, I believe Botch is actually in Edge of Coral. Is that right?
Yeah. There's a Botch show that was shot at Ground Zero.
Yeah.
And it's early. It's, I think the first LP was out. So I think,
was that Unifying Themes?
No, that was a collection of 7-inches and compilation tracks.
Oh, okay.
So the first, like, legitimate, like, I don't know why it's...
I know what you're talking about. Someone listening is going to be like, you bastard.
You know, not We Are the Romans.
Yeah.
The other one.
The other one.
So the other full length. But, yeah, so they're in there. And then I also put... I also threw the entire film of that show up on YouTube. You can find it. If you go to nobodysknows.com, which is, like, where I keep the... I've Known You Too Long podcast, and you go through the different posts there. There's a post that has all of that Botch show. So I filmed on a high camera, and there, you know, they did a lot of like strobe light effects and went from light to dark. So a lot of the show, you're just hearing the music in the dark, but you can see the entire, you know, the entire set they were playing at the time. I put that up on YouTube a couple of years ago.
I'm going to have to check that out. And that movie, it actually introduced me to Trial. Actually, that's not true. That's not true. I got a Trial CD from a pawn shop in Kent for the for the Foundation EP for like $1. I got that, and then got a compilation CD called West Coast versus East Coast Hardcore. And I got that, it was like a purple CD. I got that introduced me to like all kinds of, you know, and that was put out by like, Revelation and Victory and a bunch of bands. But, you know, those are a couple of my first hardcore CDs. But Edge of Coral, man, like it definitely introduced me to Mercy Devils and Rocky Vadalato. Let's talk a little bit about, the insanity of what it was like on set, man. Like what was the idea behind this? Obviously it's, if you're not familiar, it's a black and white film, produced by Dave Larson and it's a punks versus straight edge. On one side, we got like the Murder City Devils. On the other side, we got John Pettibone from Aris, from Himsa, from Undertow. Had you been writing it, and like, was it just going to originally be a book, or was this like the master plan to make this movie? And how did you convince all your friends to join it?
Okay. You probably won't be surprised to know that it goes back to Ron again.
Oh, yeah.
No, there was beef for a brief time in the early 90s Seattle scene between like straight edge and punk rock. And it was like Ron versus Last Gasp.
Okay.
Like Ron and Brian. And Ron had put out a Last Gasp 7-inch on Overkill. Like, Ron was into that stuff. And then I don't know what caused it. But there was all this like, and when I say there was beef, it was probably like 2 months.
Mm-hmm.
But I remember being really distraught at the time. Like, what are you guys doing? Like, I'm a straight edge guy, but I'm a straight edge guy with long hair that skateboards, and half my friends aren't. You can't do this. You can't do this. So
you were the Rocky Vodolato.
I mean, yeah, except I wasn't coming back to my hometown. And I didn't know most of the people who were fighting. I just didn't like, I never liked that, like, I always had a problem with that idea of a separation between like straight edge and like punk. Like, I always thought these were all just, look, we're all on the same side, you mm-hmm. know? That was my take on it. So I always had that in my head. And then, do you remember that there was a show, Into Another, played at the Sailors Union of the Pacific Hall in Belltown before it was El Gaucho Steakhouse?
No, I that was before my time for sure.
Lori Lefevre put the show on.
Okay.
It was Into Another in Seaweed, I think.
Oh, that sounds awesome.
Something happened outside
Uh-oh.
That show. This was like 96, I think. I may be wrong on the date, but something happened outside that show. And someone came running in and said, a guy just pulled a knife on Sea Hag. If you understand what that sentence means, I'm not going to explain it any more than that. But a guy just pulled a knife on Sea Hag, and like, dozens of people just went running out the door onto First Avenue
uh-huh.
at like 9 o'clock at night, completely empty, because it wasn't the Seattle that we have now.
Yeah.
And nobody knew where anybody, what had happened, right? But there was this idea that the group, like the group of hardcore people, was needed to stop an enemy.
Uh-huh.
So all these kids just went running down the middle of First Avenue towards where they thought this guy had run off to with his knife. And I saw this guy that I know running down the street trying to break a glass soda bottle as he was running. Like, he was running and then leaning down and hitting it.
Yeah.
And he did that until it broke off in his hand. So he had like a knife, like in The Outsiders, like a broken bottle.
Oh, my God.
And I just watched all that and like thought, this is wild. This should be a movie. This looks like a scene out of a movie. Now, of course, all of this ended with nobody finding anybody. People were just running around in the streets,
yeah.
right? But that stayed in my head. And I thought, man, if I made movies, that's the movie I'd make. I'd make this movie about people that go to shows that are like in these gangs that like run around after each other.
Yeah.
And then about a year after that, my friend Matt Matsuoka from 1007,
mm-hmm.
first band that I had on the label, he made a little punk rock movie called Heartbreak Beat. And it had Pettibone in it.
Mm-hmm.
He's a fairly major role in it. It's got Kerry Whitney is one of the main stars.
Mm-hmm.
Number of other guys from local scene. He used a bunch of music, a bunch of hardcore music. So I feel like Matt made the first hardcore movie.
Okay.
Even though he's not fully a hardcore dude, like, it was full of hardcore people. It's got Pettibone in it. And
yeah.
I'm in it, and a bunch of, you know, Greg Bennett's in it.
Mm-hmm.
So he made that, and I got to watch him film the whole thing, see how he edited it. And the difference was, as soon as he finished that movie, digital editing was starting to come out.
Oh.
So he started to make a second movie called For the Cash, kind of the same vibe, except he was going to be able to digitally edit that on a computer. And
awesome.
As soon as I saw that I'd be able to do that, I started making it, like writing Edge of Quarrel. So I'm like, okay, now I've watched someone make a movie and edit it, and now I'm watching them start again, and this time the editing's going to be easier.
Mm-hmm.
I can do this. So I watched, just like watching Ron do Overkill, I watched Matt do Heartbreak Beat.
That's cool, man. And how crazy is it that – you know, all these years later, and you kind of, it's kind of like, probably for you, it's probably just like, oh my God, this, you probably watch it back and laugh, but like, how crazy is it that it's this movie that, you know, people probably in Europe, like, watch it, and people all over the world have seen it, and it's like this, like, you know, you could probably go to Scarecrow Video, and it's probably on DVD and VHS there. What's that like to you to know that that's still out in the world being quoted and being watched?
It is embarrassing. But it is also, so here's the thing, like, there's no place where people just think it's a good movie. Like, you know what I mean? It's not like it's not like anywhere in the world, like, they don't have good entertainment, so they think so you get what I'm saying, right?
Yeah.
I think that there are people who genuinely enjoy it. I think there are people who genuinely dislike it. It just depends. Like, I tried to make as competent a film as I could for a person who had never made a film and didn't know what he was doing.
Yeah.
There are moments I cringe at when I watch them back. And to this day, there are things that I absolutely love. So some of the things I was able to get and some of the things I wasn't, you know? But yeah, it's a real trip, man. And yeah, if I go into Scarecrow, I can see it there. And if I go onto YouTube and I search Edge of Quarrel, you can find the Spanish language version of it.
Oh my God.
Professional voice actors from the film industry in Spain dubbed the movie. And let me tell you something, it's a lot better movie in Spanish.
Hey, there's a market for that. Hey, what are a couple things that you, okay, well, first off, if you were to make that today, would you still make the choice of putting it in black and white, or would you do color?
Well, the choice of putting it in black and white was because, and I think this was for Matt too, because we weren't, like, there was no money.
Okay.
It's not like when people say, oh, it's a low budget film. There was zero money. Like, how am I going to buy the next Hi8 cassette to put in this camera?
Okay.
The one camera I own, I hope nothing happens to it, right?
Yeah.
So the idea that, like, I would film something in one kind of light and the color would be off, I'd have to know about indoor and outdoor lights and kind of getting it. It was like, there was no possible way any of that was going to be able to be part of the consideration. Like, I figured black and white would mask a lot of that. So
that's a good point.
I think it's a much better movie, and I think Matt's movies also benefited from not having color in them.
Okay. Well, you answer my question, and was there ever a consideration to do a sequel?
Yeah. I mean, not real. Like I have, okay, so back around the time I was doing the Penny Project, I was working on a script for Edge of Quarrel 2, which is called True Tell Death.
Oh, okay.
But I never got past, like, I wrote about 45 pages of it. But the problem is, like, aspects of that movie that were completely fictional, that were completely just made up, no one actually disliked each other. Like, within 5 to 6 years of Edge of Quarrel coming out, some of it wasn't quite so funny anymore.
Mm.
There was kind of a rise in actual gangs, you know?
Oh, yeah.
And then, so then the idea that, or, like, those gangs had been there, but, like, they were more prominent, and they were affecting people's lives as the music scene kind of got bigger. And, you couldn't really make, like, it wasn't fun to tread those waters, because it wasn't like, oh, man, then we could do this. This would be wild. Nothing like this would ever happen. It's like, oh, how do I compete with, you know, some of the videos that are out now, people beating each other up? Like, I kind of lost my ability to work in that space.
Reality became too real.
Reality became too real. I started focusing on writing, like, horror and fantasy stories.
So let's talk about that, man. I just kind of want to finish up here, and I'm going to ask you a couple questions, but I'd like to offer you the chance to at least promote some of the stuff you do as far as your writing. So what's a good place to start if we wanted to dive into what you write?
Well, I think if you can read some of the stuff that I've written that I have posted on Nobody's Nose.
Mm-hmm.
So if you go to nobodysnose.com, spelled just like that, no apostrophes or anything, you'll find an article about the skateboard shop. It's called I Owned a Skateboard Shop in 1987. You'll find an account of the Inside Out show that we did in Bellingham. You'll find a few pieces of my writing there.
Yeah.
And You can also find a link to a short book. It's called a novella. Technically, it's even shorter than that. It would be a novelette. It's like an 89-page ebook.
Okay.
That's a sci-fi story that takes place in the world of Wool, which is a book by a guy named Hugh Howey. He wrote this thing called The Silo Saga, which is about – it's multiple books about these people that live in an underground silo because there's been some sort of apocalypse in the up-above world, and they've been down there for hundreds of years, and they yeah. don't know why they're down there. They don't know what happened.
Okay.
So he opened that up and let other people write stories in that world.
Awesome.
So I wrote a story called Shadow Killer that takes place in that, and I tried to stay as true to his original, you know, concept for the world as possible. And so that is actually, you know, that's available on Amazon. It's cheap. I think it's $2.99. Or if you have Amazon Prime or if you have, you know, Kindle Unlimited, you can read it for free. So there's links to that on my website, or you can search by my name. I write under the name David R. Larson.
Okay. Awesome. Yeah, definitely check out Shadow Killer. I have yet to check it out, too. So, but you know what? I feel like if I were to jump in right there, I would be confused. I think I need to start with the actual, start getting down to the actual like base of the world that you wrote in. So,
oh yeah, well, and the idea is that it's better if you've read Wool first.
Okay. Okay.
But if not, you can still follow what's going on in the thing I wrote.
Awesome. And so if you want to check out some of his writing, again, nobodysknows.com. And last couple of questions here. We're celebrating so the reason I wanted to talk to you about like a lot of Northwest music and Northwest rock is tomorrow is Seattle Rock Day on KISW, and they're trying to help out a lot of people in need, and they're trying to help out people and kind of lift their spirits and stuff. And is there an album from the Northwest that you would suggest, or something that for you, if you're feeling down, bummed out, anxious, depressed, just having a is there an album that you can go to and reach for, and it might be, you know, from anything here in the Northwest that you would suggest someone check out?
Well, yeah. So it's not necessarily that the music itself is uplifting, but a go-to album from the Northwest for me that not a lot of people know about mm-hmm. is the Galleon's Lap Themes and Variations LP.
You actually gave that to me. You sent that record to me because you said that you are someone who tracks that record down, and you purchase it wherever you find it.
I used to be able to do that. People have caught on. You know, Southern Lord Records kind of has a bit of a reputation now. The fact that that dude did this really phenomenal band and it was put out in such a limited way mm-hmm. back in his early days, people know that. So you don't find as many Galleon's Lap records and used record stores for $3 anymore. But I'd buy every one that I could find, and I would send them to make sure people had it, you know?
Yeah.
Send it out to somebody. So I'm glad I know I have given that record to people before. I'm glad you're one of the people.
You hooked me up, man. You hooked me up. So Galleon's Lap is a suggestion, and on that same theme, you know, going back, you know, to 1985 and your journey through punk and hardcore and underground music, and I know you're interested in you have a wide variety of taste of music. What are a few shows within the Northwest that, like, you know, flashpoint, just like immediately stand out as like iconic, breathtaking live performances that you couldn't believe were happening?
They need to be Northwest bands.
Shows that happen in the Northwest.
So I went and saw like one of my first like really great like punk concerts, I guess, where mm-hmm. like you traveled to another town, you went to a bigger show, was Circle Jerks, 7 Seconds, SGM, and Alphabet Swill at the Community World Theater in Tacoma
okay.
in 1988,
yeah.
I think. And that was – SGM ended up becoming one of my favorite bands. They put out a record where they did like this weird like rap song, and they like shouted out the Fall Out Records in it and stuff.
Nice.
We had seen them, so we thought they were awesome. Yeah, revisiting that record, they
maybe
had
not.
Some concepts in their lyrics and song titles that maybe aren't the best, but at the time they seemed like a really cool band. So that show made a big uh, made a really big impression on me. Mm-hmm. Made a real big impression on Bill Baker, too. He got beat up by skinheads.
Uh-oh.
That's another classic story from that one. So that was a big deal. Seeing Brotherhood in Lenny's basement was, for me, like the birth of real hardcore. That was the place where I was with a whole bunch of people that were only there because they knew about Brotherhood, or they knew about there was a show at Lenny's basement in Bremerton. And it was the first time a band has played and the crowd moved in a different way. There wasn't a mosh pit. It was more like this was even before like we're at a hardcore show, they'd be moshing. It'd be more just like people kind of like jumping up and down and sing along, finger pointing and kind of like piling over each other to get to the mic and stuff, you know?
Yeah.
And Ron was just like assaulting the crowd. You know, next thing you know, Ron would just like, you know, smash and knock three people over, and it was fantastic. So that show was Brotherhood and First Step, and I think Refuse out of Lenny's basement was a life changer for me.
Nice, man. Well, that's a couple rad shows, and I really appreciate you taking the time to do this interview. And you know, I'm going to go ahead and steer people to nobodysknows.com. You can find I've Known You Too Long and also the Quarter Bash YouTube page. Dave Larson, dude, is there any final words you want to say to anyone who's listening to Loud and Local who might be home right now and kind of bummed out or just needs some content in their lives? I'm sure.
Hang in there. I know everybody's having a hard time with this. I'm seeing it in the people close to me. I'm seeing everybody is kind of dealing with this in their own ways. I guess if I was going to say something to people, it's that my personal experience has been that people are kind of losing their cool faster. You know, the camel's back is closer to breaking. So little things can kind of make people lose it, freak out. If you're with some people in quarantine and somebody maybe kind of goes off the deep end because they're upset about a dirty dish or something, give people like that, like give a little bit of leeway for people to kind of maybe act out a little. That's a pressure. I feel like that's a pressure release. We've had conversations about that around that in our house here. Like little things seem bigger when you kind of can't get out in the world and you're worried about the state of the world and you wonder if your rent's going to get paid or if your family's going to be okay. All that stuff, even if you're able to put that aside, you may not have left room for you spilled the milk, you know?
Give people much more of a pass than you may have in the past.
Yes. And that includes online, social media. That includes everywhere. Like, part of coming together is just being, like trying to understand everybody's going through. We all understand right now what everybody's going through.
Yeah.
On this level. On this level. You know? Compassion.
It's a good thing. Dave Larson, thanks so much for the time and I'll talk
to you
soon, bro.
I really appreciate this. This is awesome. I appreciate it, Kevin.
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.